Hey, it's Anna Sale, and I want to thank you for listening to Death, Sex, and Money, where I explore the big questions and hard choices that are often left out of polite conversation. You can hear new episodes ad-free every week on Amazon Music, where you can find Death, Sex, and Money and all of your Slate favorites without the ads.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Stahl. I'm Slate's jurisprudence editor. Ordinarily, I edit our courts and legal coverage from the comfort of my home office in Los Angeles, but for the next month and a half, I will be locked in a lower Manhattan courtroom with the rest of the press, a jury of 12 New Yorkers, Justice Juan Merchan, prosecutors, Trump's defense team, and the former president himself as history unfolds. I've temporarily moved myself and my family from Los Angeles to New York to cover this case firsthand, like I have done in other cases, including the Paul Manafort case, the Roger Stone criminal trial, and Donald Trump's first impeachment. I'm hoping that my background knowledge of the many, many criminal travails of our former president can offer something to you, Slate's listener. Over the next several weeks, you'll be hearing from me on Amicus, Slate's legal podcast, and in articles on Slate.com, from the jury selection to the opening arguments to the witness testimony and cross-examination and the prosecution's case and the defense's case, and ultimately to a final verdict. We will be providing you wall-to-wall coverage throughout the entirety of the trial as it unfolds from the courtroom. There's no way I'd be able to do it without the support of Slate Plus. So if you're not already a subscriber, please join today by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen. Thank you so, so much.
I think I had this misconception in my mid-30s when I started thinking that I did want to have kids. I was like, oh, well, it'll be fine. Like, I'll just do IVF. Like, if I have to, I'll just do IVF. And as though that were, you know, this sure thing.
This is Death, Sex, and Money, the show from WNYC about the things we think about a lot and need to talk about more. I'm Anna Sale. Writer Dori Shafrir spent her 20s and 30s working her way up in journalism to impressive jobs at Rolling Stone and BuzzFeed. But in a lot of ways, she felt left behind, like adulthood wasn't clicking into place for her the way she'd expected. She writes about this in a new memoir with an excellent title, Thanks for Waiting, The Joy and Weirdness of Being a Late Bloomer.
I feel like I only really started thinking about that term in my, like, mid to late 30s. But I do feel like throughout my life, there were certain things where I was like, oh, I'm older. or like, I haven't done this thing yet that I feel like I should have done.
How much do you think was related to some idea of a biological clock?
I think it was somewhat related for sure. But I think I thought about it less in terms of like, oh, my clock is ticking, and more like, oh, wait, I should be doing these things too. I want kids, right?
So it was more like a fear, a sense of being left behind by your peer group.
Yeah, I recently said to someone that my book is about having life FOMO. And I think that that's really what it felt like. It was the fear of missing out on all these milestones that, to me, it felt like everyone around me was reaching.
And for you, what were those milestones when you would think, like, really bluntly, like, what were the shamey thoughts you had about the milestones you ought to be reaching?
It was getting married. It was having a kid. It was buying a house. It was being in a place with my career that I felt confident and happy and fulfilled. Those were kind of the four pillars. And it really seemed impossible for a while that I was going to reach any of them. And so I had to kind of reframe how I was thinking about the rest of my life.
Dory did that reframing while making it the focus of her work in not one, but two podcasts she now hosts. One, called Forever 35, is about taking care of yourself and being cool for women like yours truly in middle age. The second podcast she started with her husband about their efforts to get pregnant. It's called Matt and Dory's Excellent Adventure, an IVF journey. In her book and on their podcast, Dory has been remarkably candid about their infertility treatments, which can be such a frustrating and isolating experience. And that's what I wanted to focus on with her. Dory met her now husband, Matt, on Tinder when she was in her mid-30s. They married when she was 38.
I felt like I'd finally met someone who I could envision raising a child with and being a great dad. And I was really ambivalent about having children for quite some time. Throughout my 20s, I didn't say I didn't want kids, but it wasn't a future that I, you know, fantasized about or necessarily saw myself doing. And I didn't see myself as very mothering or motherly. And I worried, I think, that I wouldn't be motherly, that I just didn't have that in me. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really until when my nephew was born. And I remember just being so crazy about him. And the same thing happened when my sister had her child. And I kind of saw a side of myself come out that I hadn't really seen before. And that was when I was really like, okay, this is really something that I want. But at the same time, it was also another kind of reminder that I did not have a child. My husband and I had been trying to get, we'd been trying to get pregnant for a few months. We'd gotten married a few months earlier and nothing was happening. And I had to kind of hold both of those feelings at once, right? Like being really happy for her and so thrilled and so excited that this new person was in the world. And then also kind of feeling sorry for myself and letting myself feel that.
And how did you let yourself feel that? I think one of the things that is so, can be so tricky when we are in a moment in life when we want to be happy for someone we love, particularly a very close friend or a sibling, but it also points out the ways in which we feel some, you know, deficiencies in what we want our lives to look like, and
yeah,
how to do both of those at the same time. Like, do you think your sister was aware of those mixed feelings you were having?
I think she was to an extent because she knew that we were trying to get pregnant. And we had, you know, we talked about it, but I had practiced kind of holding both of these feelings at once. I distinctly remember feeling that way at my sister's wedding. She got married when I was 34 and she was 27. And I felt like here I was, you know, the older sister in her mid-30s, single, going to her younger sister's wedding. And I think what I felt was I remember kind of saying to myself, like, you can't let this weekend be about you, you know, like you have to be happy for her. You have to just, you know, put on the game face and power through, even if what I was perceiving was, people were, you know, kind of feeling sorry for me. And again, I don't know if that's true, but that was what was going through my mind. And so having to kind of hold both of those things was something that I feel like I was, had gotten some practice in by that time.
Did you like the outfit that you wore to her wedding?
I was a bridesmaid. She had us wear matching bridesmaids' dresses. They were purple, a lovely jewel tone purple. But, you know, it was a strapless dress. It was not something that I would have picked out for myself. I'll put it that way. I didn't hate it. I didn't get into it and feel like, oh my God, this is like horrible. But it was not what I would have necessarily picked to wear. But the rest of her bridesmaids, they were her friends from growing up and college mostly, if I remember correctly. And all very lovely people, but all very petite. And I felt, and I'm not especially tall. I'm like 5'6", but they were all very small and very thin. And I felt really awkward and big next to them in a way that made me uncomfortable. I felt like Barney. You know, this kind of like big purple blob.
When Dory was single in her 30s, she'd considered freezing her eggs, but eventually decided not to. So when she and Matt still hadn't gotten pregnant after 6 months of trying, because of Dory's age, her OBGYN suggested they see a specialist.
She told me that my husband would have to get a semen analysis in addition to all the tests that I was doing.
So you had to come home and say, sweetie, you need to do a semen analysis?
Yeah, but, you know, I think he was expecting it. I mean, I know he was expecting it because as we had been trying to get pregnant and, you know, month after month it wasn't working, he kept saying, I know the problem is me. I know the problem is me. I know I have bad sperm. And I was like, how do you know that? Like, have you ever had a semen analysis? And he was like, no, but I just know. So when I told him, okay, you have to take a semen analysis, he was like expecting it and very kind of pessimistic about it. But then when they called him with the results, it turned out he did have a low sperm count. So he was right.
When you were just having those first conversations, or when that would first come up with your husband about his sperm count, and then when you got the results, like, did you know how to talk to your husband about sperm counts in a way that felt okay?
So my husband has been a podcaster for a very long time and is remarkably open about...
It's a really funny way to start the answer to my question.
Well, because he's not like a politics podcaster. Like, he talks about personal things on his podcasts. And so in a way, I think he's just... I think, especially when we met, he was definitely a more open person than I was about this stuff and was just kind of fine talking about it. And so I never felt awkward talking with him about his sperm count. But it was interesting in those early days because I still had a lot of confidence in the medical establishment. And I thought, okay, well, our only problem is that Matt has a low sperm count. Like, that's easily dealt with. I'll be pregnant in no time. And it didn't really work out that way. But at the time, I remember just thinking, like, ugh, like, if he didn't have bad sperm, like, we would just be, we'd be able to just have kids, you know, having sex. We'd be able to have free kids. That's the other thing when you're doing IVF. It starts to seem completely bizarre that people just have sex and get pregnant.
Yeah. So when you're doing those early tests and you are beginning to have conversations with doctors, how did you begin? Did you have conversations between the two of you about how much intervention you were willing to do physically and pay for?
So we were told when we got Matt's results that our only option to get pregnant was IVF. And neither of us had insurance that covered IVF. But again, I think we thought it would work right away. So we thought, okay, this is going to be a big financial hit, but we're going to do it. And I mean, these were kind of very eye-popping numbers, like over $20,000. And we didn't have that money, which didn't feel great, you know, going into a lot of debt to pay for IVF. But it felt like our only option. And again, it felt like the clock was ticking, because now the clock, the biological clock, was really becoming present in my life. I was 39, and, you know, egg quality starts to go down very quickly after that. And the numbers of eggs start to go down very quickly. And so we knew, okay, it's kind of now or never. We got to get going. And there just felt like there was this urgency to it that was stressful.
That you almost like didn't even have time to spend to think about the decision. It was like, are we doing this or not? Because we've got to go.
Yeah. And once you're kind of on the IVF train, it starts moving very quickly out of the station. Like, I was told, oh, you have a polyp. You have to have your polyp removed. That's surgery. So, okay, gotta arrange that surgery. Gotta find someone who's gonna do it. Oh, insurance will pay for it. Great. I'll, you know, you're just kind of consumed by everything. And then it was, you know, getting the medications and doing the shots, and just everything just felt like we weren't in control of what was happening. We were just kind of going.
What do you remember as the first moment once you were on, as you say, the IVF train, when you were like, whoa, this is not the kind of quick intervention that I thought it was going to be? Like, when did that first hit you?
It was when we got the genetic testing results for our first round of embryos. So the way it works is you do these shots for about 2 weeks, and then your eggs get essentially harvested. and that's in the US at least, they put you under for that. So that's like a surgery. And then they get fertilized with sperm, and then they grow in the lab for 5 to 6 days. And on day 5 or 6, they either turn into what's called blastocysts or they don't. And if they turn into blastocysts, then they are considered potentially viable. And at our clinic, at least, for women over 38, they recommended that you send that you get them biopsied and tested for genetic abnormalities, for chromosomal abnormalities. And so that first round, we had ended up with 4 blastocysts. And so I just thought, okay, we'll get four blastocysts. Like, why would they be abnormal? And then they came back with only one was normal. And that's when I was like, wait a second. One? Just one? Like, I had had, I forget exactly how many, but I had had, I think, about 15 eggs retrieved. And then at the very end, to get one, I just thought, oh my God, what? And at the time, I didn't know that, you know, a lot of people don't get any. But in my mind, I had kind of just, again, naively assumed that this would be fine. I would get multiple embryos and get pregnant and ride off into the sunset. So I think this first round of this first egg retrieval, when I only got one normal embryo, was a real wake-up call in that regard too.
Dory and Matt transferred that one embryo that didn't have any chromosomal abnormalities, but it didn't implant. Dory didn't get pregnant.
I got a lot of people saying, like, oh, I know it'll work. I know you'll get pregnant soon. And I was like, how do you know that? How could you know that? Like, that is not, that does not make me feel better. And then, you know, I also got a lot of people who like to tell me what I called miracle baby stories. So, you know, oh, I have, you know, my cousin's friend, she was doing IVF for like 5 years, and then they decided to just stop because they couldn't take it anymore. And then she got pregnant. And I was like, you know, you're always like, okay, great, great story. And they tell you these stories with this kind of like eager look in their eye of like, oh, well, you know, this will give her hope. But it just made me feel worse, actually.
Did anyone say anything that was surprisingly comforting?
You know, I think the people who are just like, I'm really sorry, I'm here if you want to talk about it, were the best responses. And it actually taught me a lot about how to engage with people who were going through difficult things. I was grieving in a way. And, you know, sometimes I did want to talk about it, and other times I really just didn't.
Coming up, Dory does finally get pregnant, but not before racking up a lot of debt.
It was so overwhelming that a lot of times I just didn't want to know how in debt we were. Like, I didn't want to add it all up because it was so much money. And it felt, I was ashamed that I wanted to keep going.
We have heard from many listeners over the years about dealing with infertility. Many of you have pointed out it is right in our sweet spot. There is death, there's sex, and oh, it takes money. The average IVF cycle, including medication, embryo transfers, and one egg retrieval, can rise to about $25,000, and that's just for one cycle. IVF insurance coverage in the U.S. is uneven. Fewer than 20 states have laws mandating some kind of private insurance coverage for fertility treatments. And as of last year, no state's Medicaid programs covered IVF. So it is often not available for people without money to pay out of pocket. And of course, IVF is just one reason becoming a parent can be expensive, emotionally draining, or feel out of reach. Others of you might have needed other interventions because of your gender identity, or because you're unpartnered, or you're in a gay relationship. If you've had to jump through medical or legal hoops to start a family, we want to hear from you. And tell us the moment you realized that becoming a parent was going to be more difficult than you expected. Write a note or record a voice memo and send it to us at deathsexmoney@wnyc.org. On the next episode...
You just want to get out of that feeling of grief when it's overwhelming and you feel stuck. And I think for many, many years, I tried to move through versions of those stages.
The Kubler-Ross stages of grief are often presented like a roadmap through loss. But early on, Radiolab producer Rachel Cusick realized her grief after losing her mom did not work that way. Look out next Friday for our collaboration with Radiolab, when Rachel talks with her grandmother about their shared grief together.
Like, it was always in the room, loss, but I don't know how often we talked about the word grief. Grandma, do you remember ever, like, having a conversation about it?
We didn't really talk about grief. We didn't. And you know, that's probably a mistake. But it was just there. It was just so present.
Let me tell you a good story. It was late on a Sunday afternoon, and my family and I had been away and rolled into the driveway, and everyone was worn out from traveling and getting hangry. But waiting for us was a solution. A Hungry Root box filled with healthy, grabbable snacks and a few different dinner meals to choose from. We tore into this thing like a pack of wild animals and ate all the snacks. But they were healthy, whole ingredients, fresh produce. And then we were set for dinner a few hours later, which only took about 15 minutes to prep and cook and get on the table. I was so grateful to my past self for doing my current self this solid by ordering this box. And it was easy. I took a short quiz to tell Hungry Root what kinds of meat my family eats, the sorts of flavors we like, any dietary restrictions we have, or just things we're trying to avoid, and when I wanted the box to be delivered. Right now, Hungry Root is offering Death, Sex, and Money listeners 40% off your first delivery and free veggies for life. Just go to hungryroot.com/DSM to get 40% off your first delivery and get your free veggies. That's hungryroot.com/DSM. And don't forget to use our link so they know we sent you.
Hi, this is Dahlia Lithwick, host of Slate's legal podcast, Amicus. If you're listening to this show, you might be interested in Amicus's live show that we're hosting in Washington, D.C. on Tuesday, May the 14th. My colleague, Mark Joseph Stern, and I will be talking to some amazing guests, including Sherrilyn Ifill and a sitting state Supreme Court justice, all about how originalism, a relatively recently invented way of interpreting the Constitution, has taken over the Supreme Court and radically reshaped the law. It's been doctrinal rocket fuel for the conservative legal movement and facilitated the rolling back of abortion rights, the expansion of gun rights, and the obliteration of the separation of church and state. And as another wildly consequential Supreme Court term careers to its end, the court's originalists are on a tear. But there's something you can do about it, and we hope you'll join us in D.C. on May 14th to explore the possible pathways out of the current situation. Go to slate.com/amicuslive for tickets.
I want to thank you for listening and for all your support as we at Death, Sex, and Money have made our move to Slate. Your stories, voice memos, and emails have meant so much to the team. As part of this transition, there's a new way to support our show financially at Slate, our new home, and you'll get something special in return. Subscribe to Slate Plus, and you'll not only support our work on Death, Sex, and Money, you'll get access to new benefits, including listening to us and all of the other great shows Slate makes, like Slow Burn and Decoder Ring, without any ads or sponsor breaks. To subscribe, just click Try Free at the top of the Death, Sex, and Money show page on Apple Podcasts, or visit slate.com/DSM Plus to get access wherever you listen. Thanks.
This is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC. I'm Anna Sale. When Dory and Matt started the IVF process, they were still paying off their wedding. They knew IVF would be expensive, but as they went through round after round and discovered that Dory needed surgery on her uterus, going deeper and deeper into debt felt like their only option.
It was like once you kind of got one thing sorted, something else that you had never even known was a possibility cropped up. Mm-hmm. Like, I didn't know that I had a bad uterus. You know, no one had even told me that that was a thing. It felt like, you know, I was Sisyphus pushing the rock up the hill, and we're just never going to get to a point where the rock would be fully up the hill.
As these goalposts are shifting, how did you get billed?
So we got billed every appointment, and, you know, it wasn't covered by insurance. So we were just charging everything to credit cards, and we started getting very adept at the 0% interest credit card game. So we would open new credit cards and transfer, you know, huge balances to these other cards so that we could pay them off over time.
Who was in charge of that in your relationship? Who did the hunt for the 0% interest rate?
It was mostly me, but Matt would also, you know, if he got an offer for a 0% card, he'd be like, oh, I, you know, just got an offer for an American Airlines card that is, you know, or whatever. Should we apply for it? And I'd be like, yes. But I was mostly handling the transfers themselves.
In your family, and then your husband's family, was asking for help an option?
No. It wasn't an option. My parents did at one point about, I don't know, a year or so into the process, they did give us $2,000. But that was the only help that we got from them.
Did they ask how much money you were spending?
They did not.
Hey, everybody, welcome to Matt and Dory's Excellent Adventure. I'm Matt.
I'm Dory.
Leave your Apple Podcast reviews.
Wow, you really just went right into it.
And then, after 2.5 years, 5 egg retrievals, 3 embryo transfers, and 98 episodes of their weekly podcast, Dory finally got pregnant.
And my phone rings, and Dr. Kelly Beck,
DKB,
says, congratulations.
What?
And I was like, what? 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 And I was like, no. Wait, are you serious? Are you serious?
When you announced that you were pregnant in August of 2018, was it a scary thing to say out loud? Publicly?
Oh, totally. I mean, we transferred our last genetically normal embryo. I was 41. It felt like our last shot, really. And I was very pessimistic up to the pregnancy test. I was like, there's no way this worked, which really pissed Matt off. He was like, don't talk like that. And I was like, who cares? If I'm negative about it, that's not going to affect anything. You know, I was really kind of down on this whole power of positive thinking thing. I was like, that doesn't matter. Who cares? I was very pessimistic about it because I think when I had allowed myself to be hopeful, to be optimistic, I'd just been disappointed. And so being optimistic didn't even feel like an option anymore. I felt like I had to protect myself. And so I was really nervous about talking about it, even though I had to, because we had the podcast. So everyone was kind of expecting the news. But I was so nervous about miscarriage, like obsessively nervous about it. And I was constantly looking up, like, what are the statistics for miscarriage at 5 weeks? What about 6 weeks? What about for women over 35? What about for women over 40? What about for women who have done IVF? When does it go down? Like, I just got consumed by this. And I couldn't stop reading, like, stories of people who had missed miscarriages, you know, when you don't know that you've had a miscarriage and you go to the doctor and there's no heartbeat, which is so devastating. I mean, it's all devastating. But I was like, oh, that's going to happen to me. I was really nervous, I think, until about 24, 25 weeks, which was when I was like, okay, if I had the baby now, it would be in the NICU for a long time, but it would probably survive. But until then, it just felt like every doctor's appointment, every time that, you know, we checked anything, I was bracing myself for bad news.
Did you enjoy parts of being pregnant?
I enjoyed parts. I was really sick my first trimester, so that was very difficult. But then in my second trimester, after I started feeling better, probably, I'd say 2 to 3 weeks into my second trimester, I started feeling better. And then I started feeling great. Like, I started feeling really good. And I felt like, oh, I'm getting that pregnancy glow that everyone talks about. Like, I'm liking being pregnant, which I wasn't really expecting. And then I had a kind of traumatic birth. I had to be induced on my due date because my amniotic fluid was low, but the baby hadn't dropped at all. I was like, I wasn't dilated, and they tried to kind of get things moving and nothing happened, like really nothing happened. And this went on for 2 days. And then finally my doctor was like, we have to do a C-section. So we did a C-section, which was hard, and I was shaking the whole time, which I didn't know was going to happen. And then I kind of passed out right after from the drugs that they gave me. And then my milk didn't really come in, and I was in so much pain, and I couldn't pee. And like, it just was this sort of like cascade of physical things. And then I had this baby who I was so happy to have and so excited for and, you know, just in awe of. But I was also like, wait, what just happened? I think I was kind of in shock, and I also felt really overwhelmed. Like, I don't know what to do. And I felt like the fact that my birth had been so chaotic that we had kind of like gotten off on the wrong foot in a way. So that was tough.
Do you still feel like that? Getting off on the wrong foot with your son?
You know, I haven't thought about it in a while. But yeah, I mean, those memories of like those first few hours and that the couple days in the hospital after I had him are not like pleasant memories. Like I remember being in recovery after the C-section, and they put him on me for like skin to skin, and they were trying to get him to nurse, and he was kind of like scrabbling around my breast, and they were like, oh, you have flat nipples, so he can't really get a latch. And I was like, who knew that was a thing that I would have to think about? I didn't know I had flat nipples. So yeah, it did feel like there kept being these things where I was like, oh, that like that's another thing that is like preventing me from kind of bonding with my child in the way that I thought I would.
When you had your child and all of a sudden there's this human that you are parents to, did part of you feel like you were sort of emotionally exhausted from the IVF and pregnancy process that depleted you in ways that you were sort of mad about as you were becoming parents?
Definitely. I still resented the fact that I had done IVF and felt like I would, you know, always be like labeled an IVF mom.
By whom?
Who knows? The world, the you know, the faceless masses. This was just in my head of like, oh, this is me now. I'll never be able to like move past having done IVF. And, you know, to some extent that is actually, I think that was true in a way in terms of what I was just talking about with like being so scared of miscarriage. I'm sure people that don't do IVF are also very scared of miscarriage, but for me it felt like so many things had gone wrong with IVF that like of course they would go wrong during my pregnancy also.
Are you trying for a second child?
Sort of. So the round of IVF that we did where we got Henry, we also got an embryo that we were told like had a deletion on the arm of one chromosome. And we were told like, basically, we don't know what this means. It could be something that like self-corrects. It could be meaningless. Or, you know, it could be a birth defect. Like, we just don't know. So I recently had a conversation with a genetic counselor about this embryo, and she told me that it was the nature of the deletion was such that I would either have a healthy birth or it just wouldn't implant. And so I thought, okay, well, let's just go for it. So we did the embryo transfer and it didn't work. And now, you know, we're kind of, I feel like we're kind of at this crossroads where it's like, how badly do I want to have a second child? I think this is what IVF does in general. It makes you really ask yourself, like, how badly do I want this? Because you have to want it pretty badly to put yourself through everything that you have to go through in IVF. And, you know, I think if I could have a free sex baby, I would take one. But that's not in the cards. And I want to just, you know, my son is two. I want to be able to like enjoy him and enjoy his childhood and be a present mom and not just be so fixated on the idea of having a second kid that I like neglect my only child.
How much money have you paid, do you think, altogether?
I think it's probably been around $100,000.
How much of that is paid off?
It's all paid off now.
Congratulations.
We've paid it all off. Thank you.
That's incredible.
Yeah, thank you. We worked with we started working with a financial coach a couple years ago because we were in so much debt. And I was like, I don't know how we get out of this. And he really helped us figure out how to do that. So thank you, Dylan.
Does Dylan have one hot tip that you can pass on to all of us?
Oh, man. I think one thing that I've learned from Dylan is like, make things as like low touch as possible. So if you're paying off debt, like make the payment, like decide how much you're going to pay each month and make that payment automatic. And if you're saving, make that savings automatic and just try to do as much as you can that you don't have to think about it, which probably sounds obvious to a lot of people, but like wasn't that obvious to us. But it definitely helped us.
You mentioned before that going through IVF and all its various stages kind of made you adopt a very pessimistic view of both like a skepticism about the power of positive thinking. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that has that carried over into other parts of your life and how you think about what you're allowed to envision for your career or for your family or for your future? Or have you found things that have been comforting that have pushed back that sense of just feeling out of control?
So I hadn't ever really thought about it until you just asked me this, but I actually think the opposite is true in most other aspects of my life because I feel more in control of them. Whereas with IVF, I felt so totally out of control that it felt like it didn't matter what I did. It was not in my control. Like as long as if I followed my doctor's instructions and kind of did everything within my power, beyond that, there was nothing I could do. Whereas I feel like in most other aspects of my life, there is usually something that is within my power to change. And I think that has been one of the most important and difficult lessons of IVF is, you know, and I realize this is again, something that like people learn in AA, like this is a truism that people have to acknowledge that there are things we have to, you know, accept the things we cannot change. And that was really hard for me. But I had to learn to do it. And I think I don't know, I hesitate to say like well, this is what I learned from IVF. But I do think it has made me a little bit better at when I am faced with situations that are out of my control or the results of which are out of my control, I'm able to accept them better.
That's Dori Shafrir. Her new book is called Thanks for Waiting, The Joy and Weirdness of Being a Late Bloomer. Check out her podcasts, Forever 35, which she hosts with journalist and friend Kate Spencer, and Matt and Dori's Excellent Adventure, which is still putting out new episodes. Death, Sex, and Money is a listener-supported production of WNYC Studios in New York. This episode was produced by Afi Yellowduke. The rest of our team includes Katie Bishop, Emily Botine, Yasmin Khan, and Andrew Dunn. Our interns are Marty Harding and Christy Song. The Reverend John DeLure and Steve Lewis wrote our theme music. I'm on Instagram at AnnaSalePix, that's P-I-C-S. And the show is at Death, Sex, Money on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Thank you to Samantha Wood in Narragansett, Rhode Island, who is a sustaining member of Death, Sex, and Money. Join Samantha and support what we do here by going to deathsexmoney.org/donate. Dori told me that she has now achieved three of those four pillars of adulthood, marriage, kid, job, but she still wonders if she'll ever own a home.
It almost feels more important now that I have a child, because it represents this kind of stability to me, and I want to feel settled in a way that I don't totally feel right now. And I think ultimately that has been kind of a theme of my adulthood, my late bloomerdom, has been trying, you know, where do I fit in the world? Where am I going to feel stability? And how is that going to happen? And I think I've mostly figured that out, but not totally. And, you know, I think maybe we don't ever totally figure it out. I think that's the conclusion I'm coming to.
I'm Anna Sale, and this is Death, Sex, and Money from WNYC.